Common law obstruction of justice takes a variety of forms. The offense requires a showing that the defendant acted to stymie law enforcement's progress or otherwise stall an investigation, but the success of the defendant's efforts is not an element of the offense. The North Carolina Supreme Court recently found sufficient evidence of obstruction of justice in the defendant's destruction of a document sought by law enforcement, though officers recovered a digital copy of the document. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Ford, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, before we talk about obstruction of justice, there's another case about whether multiple instances of indecent liberties were part of a continuing transaction. Tell us about State v. Calderon.
Sure. This was a case we got from the North Carolina Supreme Court that came down on December 12th of 2025, a case originally out of Wake County. And the facts of the case go back to June of 2019. That was when the defendant met a young victim named Jocelyn in June of that year after a church service at a home where he was renting a room. He evidently made some comments to another person about, you know, being attracted and asking how old she was and was warned that she was young, went to middle school, that he should stay away from her. But nevertheless, a few days later, he spoke to this girl, Jocelyn, again at a pool party for some of the kids who went to the church. He then asks her for her social media information, and she gives him her Facebook contact info. So they become friends on Facebook. They start messaging. The evidence says probably every day for 1 to 2 weeks that the defendant, Calderon, asked her to go to the movies with him, sent her pictures, tell her about his day, and told her that he wanted to touch her. On July 5th of 2019, the defendant Calderon meets Jocelyn again in front of her home. Other family members are gone for a dentist appointment, so she's just there at home with her uncle and some younger siblings. Exactly what happens after that point, they note that the trial testimony diverges depending on sort of who we're hearing it from. The victim in the case, Jocelyn, testifies about sort of what happened that day, about him coming over to the house. She's going outside and she describes him. We'll talk about it in a little bit more detail, but describes him essentially kissing and inappropriately touching her in both inside and outside of the van that he came over there in. There are two young neighbors who saw what was happening there. They also were asked to come in and testify. They give a similar but not identical description of what's going on. They talk about seeing the two of them in the van, that they appeared to be, they say, sort of hugging or laying down, cuddling, and that there were, they said, some kissing that they were able to see. The defendant also testifies. He claims that he did come over there, but that it was the victim, Jocelyn, who originally came running out, that she kissed him, and he says he did kiss her back outside and inside of the van. But admits essentially kissing this victim on the neck, but ultimately denies some of the other conduct that was alleged. So there's, you know, allegations of sort of multiple, I guess you might say, moments of this kissing or inappropriate touching, both inside and outside of his van. In August of 2019, the defendant was indicted for 3 counts of taking indecent liberties with a child and 1 count of second-degree kidnapping. Another grand jury then indicts him on 2 additional charges of taking indecent liberties with a child. 3 of these charges that we're talking about relate to the defendant kissing the victim, Jocelyn. 1 is kissing her on the neck outside of the van. 2 is kissing her on the mouth inside the van, and 3 is kissing her on the mouth inside the van for a second time. The defendant objects to these charges, arguing that these kisses were not really sufficiently distinct acts that could support more than one charge or conviction. The trial court overrules that. The jury is instructed on all 3 of those counts based on these 3 different kisses, and the jury does find the defendant guilty of 3 counts of taking indecent liberty. He's
Jonathan,
found.
Could you tell in the trial court how precisely this objection was raised? Was it an objection to the jury instruction, or I think the Court of Appeals put it in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence. Is that your understanding?
Right. I think that is a motion to dismiss that's being made by the defendant. The trial started August 30th in Wake County Superior Court on September 7th. That's when the defense is making this motion to dismiss, saying that there was insufficient evidence to support all these different charges that are being raised. You know, he says these were not sufficiently distinct acts that they could support multiple convictions. It's essentially one encounter basically happening in and around the van outside of the house. As I said, he's convicted of these three counts of indecent liberties. Jury's finding him guilty. And so he gave notice of appeal. The Court of Appeals looked at this case and they said that they needed to first analyze this by addressing a threshold issue of what kind of conduct are we talking about? You know, we're talking about these three instances of kissing. They say they have to decide first, based on some case law, is kissing a touching or a sexual act? And they conclude that the kisses were non-sexual acts. So then, in deciding whether they were separate and distinct acts, they then apply this Kansas case, State versus Sellers, and they say that the kisses outside the van were sufficiently distinct from the kisses inside the van, so those could be charged as two separate things. But two kisses inside the van were not sufficiently distinct, and so it was error to have that third count. Essentially, it should have only been two. There's a dissent at the Court of Appeals, and the dissent is agreeing that they are bound by the prior decisions on this first part, right? This threshold question, saying there's a different analytical path we have to take for sexual acts versus touching, but the dissent would have argued that there were nevertheless evidence of these three separate and distinct acts, even under this Sellers test. So let me sort of explain what we're talking about, this test that the Court of Appeals was applying. They were looking at case law that we've had, James, Laney, cases on this offense. And under that case law, the indecent liberties involved touching, then multiple contacts would only support a single indictment. But if the indecent liberties involved sexual acts, then multiple contacts could support multiple indictments. You know, it's just sort of this distinction that had developed in the case law. The Supreme Court is now looking at that, you know, based on the dissent and also these petitions for review filed by both sides. The Supreme Court is saying, we're not doing that, right? They are rejecting this big idea that there is this threshold question that needs to be addressed to begin with. The Supreme Court says the indecent liberty statute does not distinguish between touching and sexual acts. So the Court of Appeals erred by applying a threshold requirement distinguishing between touching and sexual acts. A little farther down, it says, instead, the same test applies to both touchings and sexual acts, and a threshold determination is not necessary. So they are rejecting and closing the door on this different analytical path that we've seen used in a couple of different cases leading up to that. They don't see a basis for that. You know, they go back to the text of the actual statute. They're looking at 14-202.1, and they say the text of the statute does not distinguish between touching and sexual acts. In fact, neither are mentioned. And then they go on to point out there's a whole variety of acts that could be considered indecent liberties with a child that would not be a sexual act or touching. You know, I mean, there's other ways that we might get there. They ultimately conclude that the purpose behind committing the act is the, as they say, the gravamen of the offense. The particular act performed is just immaterial to that. So we're not going to use this alternative path of which kind is it. We're not going to apply this test from our case law or, you know, looking at Kansas case law. So then the question is, all right, then what should we be using instead? How do we decide if we've got one charge here or two, three, five, 10 charges? How do we draw that line? And they say the analysis we should be doing is the same thing we've seen in a number of other cases recently. They are applying our test from a case called State versus Due, what they call the distinct interruption test.
And, that was an assault case, right? That was a case involving a physical attack, I think, on the victim.
And, you know, and we've seen that applied. I mean, you know, it comes up a lot, like you say, Joe, in assaults or in these domestic violence cases. You know, we've had a lot of them that have been decided, Due, Robinson, a number of others. It's not necessarily every punch, for example, is going to be a separate count in an assault if it was really all one incident. But instead, they say what we are looking for now in these kinds of cases, and now applied in this situation as well, is we're looking for a distinct interruption that would justify saying, all right, that's where count one ends. And then when it starts back up, that's where count two begins. And drawing from how that was explained in Due, they say the state could charge a defendant with multiple counts of assault only when there's substantial evidence of this distinct interruption. And then in Due, the court gave what it called a non-exhaustive list of examples that qualify as distinct interruptions. That included an intervening event, a lapse of time in which a reasonable person could calm down, an interruption in the momentum of the attack, a change in location, or some other clear break delineating the end of one assault and the beginning of another. And so that's what they apply now to this case. And they say that Each individual contact or touching or kiss may not necessarily be a separate charge, but in the context of indecent liberties, multiple inappropriate acts could be a single charge or multiple charges, depending on the facts of the case. And so now, looking at that distinct interruption test in this case, they say the trial court did not err in denying the motion to dismiss. There was substantial evidence that would support these three different charges, based primarily on testimony. For example, according to Jocelyn, as I said, there were varying accounts of how all this happened, but in the light most favorable to the state, for example, Jocelyn's testimony was that in the van, there was this 6 to 7 minute pause or interruption between the first kiss and then the second kiss. And something like that would be a sufficiently distinct interruption to support the separate charges. And so they say the two kisses in the van were more similar to Dew's two separate assaults. And so it was proper to break that down as to three charges. So the trial court properly found that Calderon committed three separate indecent liberties. So reversing the Court of Appeals on that issue and preserving the convictions.
Well, Jonathan, it seems to me there's still a little bit of a tension in the case law, right? Because we've got the distinct interruptions test from Dew. But as I recall, there's a case called Rambert for, discharging a firearm into occupied property. And the Supreme Court has held each separate pull of the trigger will support a separate count of that offense. So when we have a new crime, isn't the question going to be, well, which test do we apply to determine how many counts are supported by this evidence?
You're right, Joe. Absolutely. And this case, I think, in some ways looks like bad news for Rambert, you know, in terms of how it may be applied. They actually say in here, however, as we did in Dew, we declined to extend Rambert to indecent liberties cases. That was the decision that they made back in Dew for the distinct interruption. They just sort of said, you know, Rambert talking about shooting a gun, that's different because there really is this decision that's being made every single time you pull the trigger. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So each shot could be charged as its own thing, but they view that as being different for whatever reason than throwing punches or kissing somebody on the neck or on the shoulder. You know,
but to get into the sexual context, right, I believe there's cases that say if you have a rape or a sexual offense that each penetration is going to support a separate count of that charge. So it's always going to be a question of like, which test do we apply? We at least now know the answer for discharging a firearm into occupied property, and now we know the answer for indecent liberties.
But I think you're right. I mean, it does seem to be an area where they're saying, which is it more similar to? Here they say, we decline to extend Rambert here because the commission of indecent liberties is more akin to assault than the discharging of a firearm. That's just sort of the judgment call that they're making, you know, that individual kisses are more like individual punches and less like individual pulls of the trigger. I mean, in a situation like this, okay, now we've got an answer for this offense, just like we've got one for assault, and we've got an answer that Rambert is preserved for the discharging firearm offenses. But I think you're exactly right. It does raise some questions. I mean, for the next offense where we're talking about distinct interruption, it may be a little tough, I think, for practitioners to forecast exactly which way the higher courts are going to say, is it more like this or more like that? So we just have to, I guess, as best we can, until we have clear answers, we just make our arguments for the similarity about which of those is a better approach that the court should take.
Second case we had on for today was State v. Allison. This was a case decided by the North Carolina Supreme Court back in December 12th, 2025. This was a case out of Burke County. Just overall, this is really a straightforward application of the North Carolina Supreme Court's recent case of State v. Phillips, construing the Castle Doctrine Statute 14-51.2. What happened in Allison back in December of 2020, Brandon Adams and his girlfriend Pamela Rogers got into an argument. Adams went to the defendant's home and then returned to see Rogers. Rogers accused Adams of cheating on her, and Adams told her to go to defendant's home to verify that he had been there. So Rogers then drove to defendant's home. Defendant confirmed that Adams had been there. Rogers and defendant started drinking. Rogers told defendant that Adams had been physically abusive. Later that day, Adams arrived at the defendant's home. Defendant invited him inside, but there seemed to be some tension or some conflict with Rogers. After a few minutes, defendant told Adams to leave. Rogers then stayed with defendant. After a little while, Adams texted Rogers, that is his girlfriend, several times, threatening to beat up defendant. Defendant left the house, drove to an ATM. He happened to drive by Adams' house on the way home. Adams got in his car and followed the defendant home, chased him into the house, and then there was conflicting evidence as to what happened exactly on the porch. Adams is there on the porch. Defendant went inside and retrieved a shotgun, pointed it at Adams, Adams still on the front porch of the house. Defendant apparently begged Adams to go home, but Adams refused. Defendant counted down from 10 or from 3 or something like that. Defendant said Adams made a forward movement and the defendant shot Adams. Adams then died from the gunshot wound and defendant was charged with first-degree murder. The matter came on for trial in October of 2022. Rogers, the girlfriend, testified that when Adams arrived at the house, defendant told him not to enter, and Adams replied that he would not enter and that he never attempted to do so. The state argued the defendant was not entitled to a Castle Doctrine instruction because Adams never entered the defendant's home. The state argued that the defense of habitation did not apply to the curtilage, which is flat wrong under the statute. The defendant requested a pattern instruction on the defense of habitation, and the trial court instructed the jury three big points here. One, that the defendant was justified in using deadly force. One, if such force was used to prevent or terminate an unlawful entry. Two, if the defendant reasonably believed that the intruder would kill or inflict serious bodily harm on an occupant. And three, the defendant reasonably believed that such force was necessary to prevent or terminate an unlawful entry. The trial court also said a person who unlawfully and forcibly enters is presumed doing so with the intent to commit an unlawful act, and that the lawful occupant, when using deadly force, is presumed to have held a reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm if the intruder was unlawfully and forcibly entering and the defendant knew it. Those are the two statutory presumptions created by 14-51.2. And then the Supreme Court pointed out that the trial court did not instruct the jury that the curtilage of a home constitutes part of the home for purposes of the defense of habitation. The defendant was convicted of second-degree murder and appealed. This was in the pipeline before the Supreme Court decided State v. Phillips, so neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals had the benefit of Phillips at the time. But before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued the trial court erred in denying his motion to dismiss and plainly erred in its instructions on the Castle Doctrine. The Court of Appeals found no error, and then the Supreme Court allowed discretionary review to address the question of whether the Castle Doctrine presumption of reasonableness can be rebutted based on evidence that the defendant did not have a reasonable fear of death or serious bodily harm. Under the Castle Doctrine statute, that is 14-51.2, the lawful occupant of a home, vehicle, or workplace is permitted to use deadly force against an unlawful intruder. That statute defines the curtilage as part of the home for purposes of that defense. The Supreme Court recognizes that although the common law generally requires a person who uses deadly force to show a reasonable belief that such force was necessary, the Castle Doctrine does not require such a showing. That was the holding in Phillips. Phillips found that the trial court erred by interjecting this additional requirement that the defendant reasonably believed that his life was in danger. The Supreme Court said that when the statutory criteria are met, a lawful occupant is presumed to have a reasonable fear of imminent death of great bodily harm, and that the presumption is rebuttable under the five circumstances prescribed by the statute. It also said that the presumption is rebuttable only by the circumstances prescribed by the statute. Here, as I said, the defendant's trial and the Court of Appeals opinion predated Phillips, but the case was in the pipeline. The Supreme Court rejected the state's argument that the Court of Appeals precedent supporting the instruction survived Phillips because it was not explicitly overruled. That's kind of an interesting principle going forward, because it's an argument I think sometimes advocates will raise. Look, I recognize that there's contrary precedent, but that case doesn't mention my case law, so my case law is still good. The Supreme Court rejected that as a matter of principle and said when the Supreme Court decides an issue of law, that overrules any case that it explicitly overrules. It also overrules any case that is in principle contrary to the ruling of the Supreme Court.
Joe, that's, I guess, maybe kind of the part of this that really jumps out at me. You know, you mentioned in the introduction to this that in some ways it's just a straightforward application of the rule that was set out in Phillips. But I guess it wasn't necessarily straightforward or crystal clear if that really was the rule after Phillips. I mean, if there's an argument to be made that, hey, that's just dicta, that wasn't necessarily binding on all these other circumstances. And I mean, to me, I guess that sort of seems like one of the big takeaways from this Allison case, right, is that whatever you might have thought about if Phillips was questionable or debatable or limited, this case seems to be saying, no, it's not. It meant what it said, and that's going to be the binding rule going forward.
Right, and that comes up a little bit in the dissent that two justices made to this opinion in Allison. We'll get to that in just a moment. Here, the Supreme Court said that the trial court erred by instructing using that reasonableness element in the instruction, that there was also an error in the instruction that the presumption of a reasonable fear or serious bodily injury could be rebutted by any evidence to the contrary, and that it was the jury's role to determine reasonableness. That is the particular proposition that Phillips rejected. The Supreme Court also found error in the omission from the instruction that the home is defined to include the curtilage. That's relevant because the victim in this case was not inside the home, but on defendant's porch. If, as here, the state fails to present evidence of the prescribed circumstances to rebut the presumption, the Supreme Court said, the jury may not consider whether the defendant reasonably believed the degree of force used was necessary to prevent a forcible entry or terminate an unlawful entry. The Supreme Court recognized that it was reviewing for plain error. The defendant had not objected to this instruction. In fact, there's some indication that the defendant himself had requested the pattern instruction. But the Supreme Court, reviewing for plain error, reiterated that that's kind of this three-factor test. First, whether there was error. Secondly, whether it was prejudicial, whether it had a probable impact on the jury's verdict. This third component that the Supreme Court in recent years has given more content to, that the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. But in this case, the Supreme Court found all three of those elements satisfied. It said the instructions were erroneous and rise to the level of fundamental error. It said a properly instructed jury would almost certainly have returned a different verdict. And then the North Carolina Supreme Court said the error led the jury to base its guilty verdict on lawful conduct, satisfying the requirement that the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the proceedings. Accordingly, the Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and remanded for a new trial with proper instructions. There was that dissent, as you pointed out, Jonathan, from Justice Riggs, and it was joined by Justice Earls. The question was whether that holding in Phillips about whether the circumstances that can rebut the statutory presumptions are exclusive, whether that list of the five circumstances does or does not admit of other possible unstated circumstances that might rebut this presumption of reasonable fear. Here, the Supreme Court came down hard on Phillips, saying Phillips held that it was not dicta, and it formed part of the error in the instructions here. The dissent takes an opposite position and said, look, we recognize Phillips said that, but doing a strict interpretation of the statute does not use the word only. It lists these circumstances that can rebut the presumption, but those circumstances are not intended to be exclusive. And consequently, the dissent would have reached the conclusion that there is no error in the instruction that the jury could consider these other circumstances to rebut the presumption of reasonableness established by the Castle Doctrine statute.
For better or worse, if that's going to be the rule, then that's the rule. And so now we have some clarity on it from this opinion. But, you know, prosecutors who I think before and even after Phillips that have been doing these trials where the issue has come up, they're trying to figure out what should these jury instructions look like. Some of those cases, if they were convictions, are now already going to be in the appellate pipeline. And I thought there was sort of some interesting discussion of that in those footnotes, you know, to 2 and 3, where they're talking about some of these issues with, yeah, we know there's going to be cases coming that were decided under the old rules and something to the effect of, well, we just are hoping the pattern jury instruction committee will get them correctly framed as quickly as possible, right?
Yeah, there's something in the footnotes to the effect of that they have a great deal of faith in the pattern and jury instruction committee, and they expect them to do it correctly, not necessarily so quickly that it comes out with maybe the wrong result. But hopefully we'll get an instruction that corresponds with Phillips sooner or later.
And in the meantime, for prosecutors, I mean, if this is an issue that's going to be in your case next week, then I just sort of would flag that for people as an issue, right? We can't just necessarily print out the pattern jury instructions and trust that they're going to be right. I mean, I think that's what the defense requested in this case, right? Were the pattern instructions.
The other kind of, so Jonathan, as you know, I was an appellate attorney for a long time. And the thing that jumped out at me about this, the defendant had requested the pattern instruction on defensive habitation and apparently got that instruction and then turned around and argued plain error on appeal. Typically, that would result in an appellate court saying if there was any error here, that error was invited. The Supreme Court said the invited error argument was not one that the state apparently made before the Court of Appeals, so it was not going to consider that argument. There should be a little bit of insurance if the defendant is asking for the instruction. He's not supposed to be able to turn around and argue that there was error in the instruction that he requested. But this case indicates that does require the state on appeal to make that argument that the argument is waived. And where the state does not make that argument, it might not insulate that position from review on a later Supreme Court review.
But I mean, certainly rather than relying on that or an invited error, I guess obviously what we're telling folks is we now at least have some clarity on how it is that they may be able to rebut those presumptions and how they cannot in the wake of Phillips and Allison. So we just need to, whether that's reflected already in the pattern instruction by the time you're arguing that at trial or not, we need to make sure we've got it written correctly, that we're only rebutting it by those things that are allowed under the statute.
That's right.
So then the last one we had on was State versus Ford. This was a case also from this December 12th set from the North Carolina Supreme Court, a case originally out of Buncombe County. This happened back on a Monday in May 17th of 2021. The defendant is a guy named Scott Everett Ford, and he owns one of these event rental companies where they come set up tables, chairs, and tents for weddings and things like that. He's been running that business. This is relevant. He's been running that business in the same region of Asheville for about 21 years. And he's got some 20-odd people that work for him. On this day, on Monday, May 17th, he's driving back from one of their events in one of their white Ford F-150s from a job out of town. He's got one other employee, a person by the name of Manos, who's also in the truck with him. They get to this intersection near exit 44 off of I-40 in Asheville. At that intersection, there's a person named McPherson. They describe as an unhoused individual who regularly panhandled at that spot. And this person, McPherson, has a cat named Thomas. And Thomas apparently was always either on McPherson's shoulder or inside of a stroller that someone had given to McPherson. And the cat, he would, I guess, sort of transport the cat around in that stroller. They describe him as saying that Thomas was a very popular character around Asheville. Everybody knew McPherson. He was widely known as the cat man, who was basically never without this cat, Thomas, as they say, either on his shoulder or in the stroller. Ford has had some issues with McPherson in the past, feels like he's been harassed by him. So on this day, Ford decided to harass McPherson by, they say, flicking a golf ball at him as he's coming through this intersection. But he stopped, and McPherson then picks up the golf ball. So now Ford, afraid that McPherson might, you know, throw it back at him and break the windshield, decides to drive into this grassy lot where McPherson was, and he hits the stroller that the cat Thomas is inside of. He then pulls off and drives the rest of the way back to this business, classic event rental. There's two witnesses to this by the names of Stewart and Schlenk. They saw what happened. Actually, one of them was able to film part of the incident. So they saw that Ford in the car looked really upset, mad, grimacing, and they say he just went straight for the stroller with the cat in it. They called 911, and just sort of relevant to showing how, I guess, known the cat was in the community, they call 911, and before Schlenk can even mention Thomas, the dispatcher on 911 says, "How's the cat?" And the answer to that question is that Thomas, the cat, they say, was physically unharmed, fortunately, but is described as screaming bloody murder and he's shaking, and that evidently after this, he would not willingly get in the stroller and was a lot less friendly to strangers. So police begin investigating this. They call Ford. They're asking him, trying to get information about who was driving the vehicle that time. Ford says he doesn't know. He's trying his best to figure that out. Officers come by the business. They're asking for documentation about, well, who's the identity of the driver that would have been behind that truck? And Ford says he has no clue who would have been driving that particular F-150 that day. We got a lot of employees, a lot of trucks. We just throw keys at people and tell them to go. On May 21st of 2021, officers come back with a search warrant. They say they're giving Ford one last chance to just be honest and provide them with some kind of documentation about who the driver would have been. This time, we go back into a warehouse behind the business. There's a podium there, and on the podium, there's these spreadsheets of every day's work assignments. But the defendant says that, you know, we also regularly throw those out, throw them in the recycling. So they go look in the recycling, and interestingly enough, in the recycling bin, they find the record for every day except the day in question when the truck ran over the stroller. But they also seize the defendant's cell phone and they look at the contents of it. And on there, they find a digital copy of the schedule for that day, May 17th. That actually indicates a different person who was driving that F-150 anyway, a person named Mo that was likely a different employee. But nevertheless, based on all the evidence they found and the witness statements and so forth, the defendant is charged with two things: felony obstruction of justice for essentially trying to hide the documentation about the truck for that day, and then felony cruelty to animals. The defendant filed a motion for a bill of particulars asking for more information about exactly what the obstruction of justice was. And so the state provides that bill of particulars saying that it was about trying to dispose of this physical copy of the schedule for that day. The defendant is convicted of both charges at trial. He appeals to the Court of Appeals on the obstruction of justice and the cruelty to animals charge. The Court of Appeals agreed with the trial court that there was sufficient evidence to submit the obstruction charge to the jury because it could support a reasonable inference by the jury that the defendant deliberately destroyed the document, trying to subvert the investigation into what happened. On the felony cruelty, they also affirmed at the Court of Appeals But they did that on the basis of saying that the defendant knew or should have known that the animal was inside the stroller when he rammed the truck into it. He appeals that up to this court. This court allows further discretionary review, and they're looking at those two charges to decide if they were sufficiently proven by the state. And ultimately, the court says yes to those questions, but they get there in a little bit of a different way. So on the obstruction of justice charge, they're agreeing with the Court of Appeals that obstruction of justice means direct or indirect opposition or resistance to an officer's lawful discharge of his official duty. And we have that here. You know, there is evidence, or at least evidence in the light most favorable to the state, of likely disposal or destruction of the document that was being sought by law enforcement. And they cite in case law, they say that could certainly constitute obstruction of justice. The success of the attempt to obstruct justice is not a necessary element of the obstruction charge. In other words, the fact that they did ultimately find another copy of this record, and that the record really wasn't the linchpin evidence of showing that he was behind the wheel on that day anyway, that does not mean it's not obstruction of justice, that he clearly, in the light most favorable to the state, took steps to try to destroy or hide that evidence to make it harder for them to figure out who was driving that day. They also addressed the idea that, but wait, you know, I mean, it's our regular business practice to throw this stuff out once the event is done. We put it in the recycling bin. The possibility that it could have just been innocently disposed of in the recycling bin, and it is just pure coincidence that it is only this day that is missing from the recycling bin, even though five other days from that week are sitting right there, that does not foreclose the possibility that there was an attempt at obstruction of justice that was being made. And they point to other facts that would support that in the light most favorable to the state, right? This denial of knowledge, oh, I have no idea who was driving that truck that day. And, you know, that's directly contradicted by other witness testimony. They, based on those kind of things, they say a jury could reasonably infer that someone intentionally removed the physical copy of the May 17th schedule and that he was the one who was originally driving that. So,
Jonathan, this is obstruction of justice is a common law offense. And I seem to remember there are some cases from the Court of Appeals end of last year talking about maybe there's an additional element that the defendant had to have the intent to obstruct an investigation. Did the Supreme Court enumerate the elements of this offense in like a clear and straightforward way so that we know precisely what is involved in an obstruction of justice charge?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, as you say, this is a common law offense. And I don't think from here we've really got a crystal clear, you know, one, two, three of exactly this is what would qualify and this would not qualify. I mean, they just say that obstruction of justice just requires a showing of, you know, the defendant's acts, in their words, acts to stymie law enforcement's progress or otherwise stall investigation of the matter. You know, that, so there's a variety of ways a person could engage in conduct that would constitute obstruction of justice. And this was another example of one that would qualify. The success of the efforts were not critical, and so they felt like there was enough evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the state. It was proper to go to the jury, and it was up to them to decide whether it had been proved or not.
I don't know how clever this defense is to say, look, my obstruction was not successful because you found the document, right? This is a defendant saying, look, I didn't commit an assault because the person wasn't terribly injured or something like that. Again, the Supreme Court's going to say the failure of the attempt to perform a criminal act doesn't mean you're not guilty of having done something illegal, right?
I agree. But, you know, it is. I think that is an important distinction that they are saying several times in here. The success of the attempt, they're saying, is not an essential element of the offense. So I think it's important to marry that up with what you were asking about earlier, Joe, you know, where they say common law obstruction of justice takes a variety of forms from this In re Kivett case, but they say most often the court has defined the offense as any act which prevents, obstructs, impedes, or hinders public or legal justice. And so, I mean, that would be my takeaway is you might still be impeding or hindering even if it's not ultimately successful. So that's, I think, an important one for the prosecutors to take away. Just in our final minutes here, I think the other charge that we had was the cruelty to animals. He was convicted of that. The Court of Appeals said it was a proper conviction based on the fact that the defendant knew or should have known that McPherson would have the cat, Thomas, either, you know, with him, on him, or in the carriage. And so based on that, that was sufficient for them to find the necessary intent element for this cruelty to animals charge, because he knew it was in the stroller or should have known in the stroller because he's had Thomas for years and everybody knows him as the cat man. Everybody knows the cat is always in the stroller. But they agreed that it was error for the Court of Appeals to use that should have known language because they say, no, this statute requires actual knowledge. I mean, if he needed to actually know that the cat was in there, And the reason they say that is because the statute, 14-360, requires that the defendant acted maliciously, which then means he acted intentionally and knowingly in doing what he did. And so that means maliciously means an act committed intentionally and with malice or bad motive. And intentionally means committed knowingly and without justifiable excuse. So in other words, we need to prove actual knowledge for him to be guilty of this offense. So, but what they say is that the Court of Appeal erred in the language that they were using. But they agree ultimately with the conclusion that they reached that there was sufficient evidence of that here for all the reasons that we just talked about. You know, this defendant Ford, he's run this business for 20 years. There's a community-wide reputation that this guy has. There's further testimony about how Ford specifically has had interactions that he found irritating or frustrating with McPherson at this intersection. You know, he's driving past it all the time for the business that he runs. And even the other witness, this Manos, who was in the truck with him, testified at trial and said that moments before the collision, he looked up and said, I don't know why it's phrased this way, but that he looked up and he saw the kitty right before the collision happened. So, you know, there was abundant evidence that anybody would have, not just would have, but did know right moments before it happened that the cat, unfortunately, was inside the stroller. So they clarify that the state was required to present evidence of actual knowledge, but they did present sufficient evidence of that in this case. And so at the end of the day, they are modifying and affirming this opinion that came up out of the Court of Appeals. So the defendant is guilty of both the obstruction and the cruelty to animals.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discuss State v. Calderon, applying the distinct interruption test and finding sufficient evidence to support three separate convictions for indecent liberties with a child, State v. Allison, holding the trial court plainly erred in its jury instructions on the Castle Doctrine, and State v. Ford, finding sufficient evidence of common law obstruction of justice in the defendant's destruction of a document sought by law enforcement. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in beautiful Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.